is that we drive around our neighborhoods, we look for any type of suspicious vehicles or any type of ICE activity so that we can document and then alert the community so that our people have the chance to defend themselves, protect themselves and their families from being kidnapped. And so this is peaceful work. We don't advocate for violence. We don't break any laws. We have a legal team who's advised us on what we can and cannot do. So we're really clear about what we're doing. We train people and we're all over Los Angeles, and there isn't a corner in the city where an ICE raid can happen where we won't know about it in less than 5 minutes. And we can deploy our members to go to document and to defend the community. That's the type of work that Amanda was doing heroically. That's the type of work that we're doing every day. As a teacher right now, we're getting ready to go back to school. This Thursday, school starts in Los Angeles, and there's a lot of fear on the part of students, parents, and teachers. And so we have to get our city ready, because we know that these ICE raids, although they did slow down a bit, they have continued, and we have to defend ourselves. We have to be organized in case anything happens near one of our schools.
We only have 20 seconds, Ron. I just talked to California Attorney General Bonta, who's brought dozens of lawsuits against Trump. Yet your organization is accusing the California police of working with ICE.
Absolutely. You know, while the legal folks are fighting in the courtrooms, we're fighting in the streets. And while they're having winning battles in the courtroom, we're winning battles in the streets. We know that what's happening right now with the LAPD and sheriffs in Los Angeles is complete collaboration with these ICE raids. They protect, they
we're
do logistical
have to leave
protection
it there, but we're
going to
do
operations.
A Spanish interview at democracynow.org. Ron Goches with Unknown Del Barrio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Neocani Coast Art and Music Cultural Foundation, presenting Rockaway Beach Music Festival, an all-ages music and arts festival in Rockaway Beach on August 16th and 17th. The event will feature live music, local food, art exhibits, and local craft vendors. More info at rbmusicfest.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County will ping your telephone this coming Thursday.
At the age of 79, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden will run for a sixth term in the U.S. Senate.
And in national news, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. cancels more funding for mRNA research.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 11, 2025. I'm Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Terrence Burns. A Multnomah County test alert will ping up to 1 million phones on Thursday. Around 2 p.m. this Thursday, August 14th, residents and visitors of Multnomah County will receive a text message and alarm sound from their phone. No action is required, but the county is testing the alert systems to identify any potential problems before it is used for an actual emergency. People who receive the alert should not call any emergency or non-emergency lines. Residents in the neighboring counties may get an alert as well if they overshoot the people who need to be alerted. Better too many than too few. The alert systems are being tested as disasters mount around the country, notably from human-caused climate change. The flooding in Texas and the wildfire in Hawaii last year were made especially deadly due to insufficient alert systems. The text message that will go out with the alert will say the words test in the text message.
The Ross Island Lagoon has another algae bloom accumulating, and though there is still no advisory for the lagoon, KBOO's Hannah Francis has more on the story.
A ruling by a federal court in Montana has major implications for wolves in Oregon. The federal judge ruled that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service violated the Endangered Species Act by denying protections for gray wolves in the western United States. Conservation groups had sued the agency, arguing it failed to properly evaluate threats to wolf populations. The decision requires a new assessment based on the Endangered Species Act and best available science. Srishti Kamal with the Western Environmental Law Center says this is a much-needed victory for Oregon wolves.
They basically sent Fish and Wildlife Service back to the drawing board to reevaluate the threats and make an assessment using the best available science. Now, this is opening the door to the whole state being listed. Potentially.
Wolves in western Oregon are already protected under the Endangered Species Act, but in the eastern third of the state, where most of Oregon's wolves live, they can legally be killed for predation of livestock. If all western wolves gain federal protection, killing them would become illegal. Kamal says it isn't certain that western gray wolves will gain Endangered Species Act protection after this ruling, but she hopes the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will recognize, based on the science, that they need greater protection for their populations to recover.
Under the Endangered Species Act, there is much stricter rules and regulations under which you can take an endangered species.
Despite the victory, wolves still face political threats. A bill introduced to Congress in January seeks to remove Endangered Species Act protections for gray wolves in the lower 48, mirroring the 2011 delisting of Northern Rockies wolves. If passed, all wolf management would shift to state control. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Ron Wyden is going to run again for Oregon's U.S. Senator. He will be 79 by the time of re-election. Wyden has had a complicated political history. He has served 5 terms as Oregon's U.S. Senator and plans to run for a 6th. There are mounting concerns around Senator Wyden's age. A Democratic lawmaker voiced at a recent town hall that Amanda Littman, co-founder and director of Run for Something, an organization recruiting and supporting young people into getting into politics, said, quote, "I've constantly called for all elected officials over the age of 70 to make this their final term, to step down with dignity and make room for the next generation of leaders." Even amid concerns of losing Democratic power in an already Republican Senate and House, concerns over having enough young people are beginning to take precedence over holding on to the waning power that exists in the hands of the old Democrats. Many Democrats are especially concerned about this after Joe Biden pulled out of the election too late and lost steam for the presidency, instead of allowing Kamala Harris to campaign before. In Wyden's career, he has held 1,125 town halls, a tool that he values highly in reaching the public and advocating for everyone across political lines. Congressional Republicans have been avoiding town halls more and more as protesters become a common occurrence as facing their constituents becomes a more daunting task for many. Wyden has had a sprawling career in his time, and he has done many things to support the people, including introducing the Cahoots Bill, and at the most recent town hall stated that he believed the immigration system is broken. But there has been also widespread outrage over his recent vote to send more weapons to Israel. His age outside of his politics remains a point of concern and contention as younger voters hope to maximize politicians' investments in their futures.
The Ross Island Lagoon has another algae bloom accumulating, and though there is no advisory for the lagoon, KBOO's Hannah Francis has more on the story.
Today and yesterday are among the hottest days of the year. Many people, especially those without central AC, are looking for respite in Portland's rivers. The cooling resource of the Willamette River is in question as another algae bloom threatens to spill out of the Ross Island Lagoon. Despite the fact that there is currently no warning in place, the lagoon is full of algae. The situation is not safe for dogs and most animals and can create health concerns for humans as well. Ringleader of Portland's HAP, Willie Levinson, says that Selwood Riverfront is still safe at this point, but that could change rapidly.
In 2023, this situation set up very similarly when it seemed stable in the Ross Island Lagoon in terms of the harmful algae bloom, and then a couple hot days, suddenly it just spilled over into the Willamette and caused a recreational advisory from Selwood to Kelly Point Park. So these things can happen quick. With the bloom in the lagoon, this is a particular time to be vigilant with pets. Pets drink river water, it gets on their dander. Harmful algae blooms can kill dogs. So, you know, this is a really important time to be careful of that. And as we'll see on the tour, inside the lagoon, we'll see streaking, we'll see deep coloration and formation of the harmful algae bloom. And then other areas when we come back to Selwood. At this point, Selwood is fine, appears to be fine, but these situations can change very quickly.
Mary Stites is the staff attorney with Northwest Environmental Defense Center, or NEDC.
What makes an algal bloom is a mix of stagnant, turbid water that is loaded with nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen that we get, you know, from people using fertilizer on their lawns, for example, and then really warm temperatures is what allows that bacteria to proliferate in the waterway. So these really, really warm temperatures are a huge contributing factor. And it's rather unfortunate that the warm temperatures are what would compel someone to want to jump in the river on a hot day. It's kind of the opposite side of the same coin of a problem, but the idea was that if we could better control the algal bloom, we could make sure that people could use this as a public health, access to waterways. That was kind of the vision.
NEDC won a lawsuit and created a plan to prevent these algae blooms, but there are general concerns about these agreements not being respected.
I have a number of questions that I'd like to have answers to. I don't understand why there's not a harmful algae bloom advisory in the lagoon. I don't understand why it hasn't happened earlier in the season. NEDC negotiated a very strong settlement with DEQ that can trigger a trigger Ross Island sand and gravel to mechanically skim the surface and put up a boom to contain the harmful algae bloom in the lagoon. That can only happen when there's an OHA advisory. OHA advisories can be done from cell density. That is a threshold that could have been met a month ago. So it's very frustrating that they didn't utilize that tool that NEDC worked so hard to do, because that ultimately is something that would be already paid. It would not cost the public. Ross Island Sand and Gravel is required to do this, but not until there's an advisory.
Yeah, so I guess in April of 2023, we sued the Department of Environmental Quality for their issuance of what's called a water quality certification to Ross Island Sand and Gravel to basically facilitate the ongoing reclamation that has been going on for decades now. That water quality certification, it's a pretty technical document, but it basically says it's the state's thumbs up that this activity will not further hinder water quality standards. So making sure that the beneficial uses of the waterway, like contact recreation, commercial fishing, for example, those all need to be protected in furtherance of the reclamation plan.
Stay tuned for an in-depth piece at 5:30 on the Ross Island Lagoon algae blooms. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
Trump's meeting with Putin could impact Taiwan's security as well as that of Ukraine. With that story and more, it's Simone Perez with the 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
President Trump will end this war in a way to prevent a third invasion and not to entice China to take Taiwan. We're not out to humiliate Putin. We're out to get a deal to make sure there's no third invasion.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham tells Meet the Press that the U.S. should take a stance with Russia on Ukraine that will warn China away from invading or blockading Taiwan. President Donald Trump will meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska Friday, the first time the Russian president has been on U.S. soil in a decade. Putin says Ukraine should give up some of its eastern territory in return for an initial ceasefire. Trump has seemed open to that, but Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky and European allies have flatly rejected it, arguing Putin is untrustworthy and the deal would give him what he wants before negotiations start. Republican Iowa lawmakers say new legislation there aims to combat liberal indoctrination at public universities. Educators say they're trying to limit academic and speech. Labor unions, graduate students, and faculty at the state's three public colleges have formed the Iowa Higher Education Coalition in response. University of Northern Iowa professor Chris Martin says they want to especially defend the independence of faculty not protected by tenure.
You want to have discussions in classrooms where professors feel they can talk about anything that's related to that class, and they shouldn't feel like they can't say certain things and risk getting fired.
Iowa's Board of Regents has already gotten new authority to accept or reject curriculum. Two Texas court cases could decide the fate of out-of-state telehealth abortion services. Both cases challenge blue state shield laws, which protect medical professionals who provide abortion medicines. A Texas man is suing a California doctor for prescribing and then sending his girlfriend the medication, and a Texas judge already ruled in favor of Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's civil suit against a New York doctor. Both cases could end up being appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. Natalie Birnbaum is with the Reproductive Health Initiative for Telehealth Equity and Solutions.
These healthcare providers are operating and utilizing the protection of their shield laws in their states, and the providers that are the targets of these lawsuits are operating under the scope of practice of their licenses in those states.
The North Carolina General Assembly has overridden a governor's veto of legislation, making it harder to approve new environmental regulations. The legislature will now have to approve rules estimated to cost industry more than $20 million over 5 years. Stephanie Schweikert with the North Carolina Conservation Network says it'll grind rulemaking to a halt and harm efforts to do things like remove dangerous chemicals from tap water.
Our state is really dealing with the impacts of chemicals in our drinking water, and the RAINS Act will make it a lot less likely that we get strong rules in place that will give families safe water to drink.
I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the St. John Island Lagoon algae bloom with Human Access Project. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. We are currently in an extreme heat warning. Today has been at or almost at 100 degrees here in Portland. We will reach a low of 67 later tonight, and tomorrow it will be maintaining the heat high with a high of 97 and a low of 64. Today in 1950, Steve Wozniak designed his first Apple computer. The quote of the day is from Kenyan biochemist, poet, scientist, and author Alu Dinesh Obiero. He says, quote, "Power without wisdom is uncontrolled fire. It destroys more than it creates."
U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he wants to improve indigenous peoples' access to traditional foods, but at a tribal health center in Alaska, he said he wasn't sure how to do that. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he wants to improve Indigenous people's access to traditional foods. Standing outside a tribal health center in Fairbanks, Alaska, Kennedy told reporters last week he's collecting ideas, but is not exactly sure how to achieve that goal.
I'm trying to figure out ways I can use my agency and my relationships with the other secretaries to return those foods.
Kennedy made a few stops at healthcare facilities in the state. In Anchorage, he went so far as to call processed foods' impact on Native health part of a, quote, genocide. The center where Kennedy spoke in Fairbanks is operated by Tanana Chiefs Conference, or TCC. The nonprofit tribal organization aims to support health and social service needs of its 42 members, 37 of which are federally recognized tribes. TCC Chief Brian Ridley says the secretary's pledge is just a starting point, but encouraging.
He seems totally on board with working with us, trying to do what we can in those areas to try to get back to our traditional foods so that they're healthier. And it's just a matter of working with him and the senators going forward on trying to find a way to actually make that happen.
The press event took place after Kennedy toured the health center with Alaska's U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan. Light Up Navajo is an annual aid program meant to help electrify rural and remote households across the Navajo Nation, the largest reservation in the U.S. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the project reached a major milestone earlier this month.
With help from nearly four dozen public and private utilities spanning 20 states, the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, or NTUA, says volunteers installed 41 miles of power lines and hooked up 196 homes this year alone, now surpassing 1,000 dwellings in all. Typically conducted over the summer months, Light Up Navajo began as a six-week pilot in 2019 between NTUA and the American Public Power Association. 6 years later, it's now a 14-week endeavor. NTUA estimates about 10,000 households are still in the dark. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A nonprofit in New Mexico that supports Native American communities wants Congress to restore funding for an employment and training program. KUNM's Jeanette Didios has more.
Among ongoing federal funding cuts, the Native Professional Advancement Center is urging Congress to reverse a budget proposal that would eliminate money for Native workforce training programs. The center's board chair, Lorraine Edmo, recently sent a letter to Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro, a ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, requesting action to restore $60 million. Executive Director of the Center, Darius Lee, says the elimination of federal funding, quote, undermines decades of progress and violates the government's responsibility to honor tribal sovereignty. According to a press release by the organization, the federal budget proposal by the Trump administration is calling for the elimination of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and instead creating a new state-controlled block grant called Make America Skilled Again. If created, it would cut tribes and nonprofits from direct access to workforce resources, force tribes to compete with the state for funding, and shut down culturally specific support systems that have helped Native people earn employment. The House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to possibly take another vote on this portion of the budget on September 2nd. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary, canceled nearly $500 million in grants and contracts designated toward the mRNA vaccine research development. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, mRNA vaccines were widely used to prevent influenza, RSV, MERS, coronavirus, and also rabies. When the pandemic began in 2020, mRNA vaccines were instrumental in combating COVID-19. The canceled funding had been awarded to the 22 research projects managed by the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA. Scott Hensley, a University of Pennsylvania immunologist who works on developing mRNA vaccines, said, quote, "This is a bad day for science," end quote. This recent move by Secretary Kennedy is just the latest major cut to mRNA funding in recent months. In May, HHS ended a $600 million contract with Moderna to develop a bird flu vaccine using mRNA technology. mRNA vaccines from Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna helped protect millions of people during COVID-19. That same technology was honored with a Nobel Prize in 2023. Kennedy recently said, quote, as the pandemic showed us, mRNA shots don't work well against viruses that affect the lungs and throat, like COVID and the flu, end quote. Jennifer Nuzzo, director of Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health, said, quote, had we not used these life-saving mRNAs, vaccines to protect against severe illness, we would have had millions of more COVID deaths. By issuing this wildly incorrect statement, the secretary is demonstrating his commitment to his long-held goal of sowing doubts about all vaccines, end quote. HHS says it plans to support other types of vaccines, like whole cell vaccines, which were widely used in the past. Those older vaccines, such as those used for whooping cough in the 1990s, were linked to the side effects like high fevers and seizures. This story is informed by reporting from the Infectious Disease Advisor.
The United States Air Force just announced it will not let transgender service members who have served between 15 and 18 years the option to retire early. It intends to remove them from service without normal retirement benefits. Members are feeling betrayed and are devastated by the move. Transgender service members must now make a choice of either taking a lump sum separation payment normally offered to junior troops or be involuntarily removed from service. Either course of action would result in a substantial loss of financial, medical, and other benefits worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to each individual. Normally, a member of the military is eligible for retirement benefits after serving actively for 20 or more years. Those benefits include one-half to three-quarters of their base pay, as well as access to military bases, commissary rights, and free medical care at military clinics and hospitals for life. Quote, unquote, medical retirement offers the same types of benefits. Even though service members with 15 to 18 years of honorable service were permitted to apply for an exemption to policy, no exceptions were approved. About a dozen service members who had been notified that they would be able to retire before the decision was reversed. The Pentagon was given permission in early May by the Supreme Court to move forward with a ban on all transgender troops serving in the military. Shortly after, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced openly serving transgender troops could either volunteer to leave and take on a large one-time separation payout or be involuntarily separated at a later date. A military official told reporters back then that they were viewed the policy as demonstrating dignity over respect. However, last month, transgender troops told military.com that the separation process, which changed their service records back to their birth gender, was dehumanizing and cruel. Under the latest policy, active duty troops had until June 6th to voluntarily identify themselves and receive a payout, while members of the National Guard and Reserve had until July 7th. Pentagon officials have already stated that they plan to presume commanders to find any transgender service members who do not come forward.
An Alabama program paid homeowners to fortify their roofs. The program, funded by insurance companies, helped homes better withstand a 2020 hurricane, a recent study found. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2020, Hurricane Sally barreled ashore in Alabama, damaging thousands of homes. But some people's houses fared better than their neighbors. In Alabama, a program funded by insurance companies pays for homeowners in coastal counties to retrofit their homes to what's called the Fortified Roof Standard. Improvements include sealing the roof deck to minimize water intrusion and attaching the roof to the walls with stronger nails.
And that keeps the roof boards from being pulled off from the rafters.
Lars Powell is at the Center for Risk and Insurance Research at the University of Alabama. In a recent study, his team analyzed thousands of claims to see how effective these improvements turned out to be in a real storm situation.
Hurricanes, first time that a large strong storm hit a critical mass of fortified homes.
They found that meeting the fortified roof standard reduced claim frequency by 56%. And for those fortified homes that were damaged, the losses were less costly on average. It shows that as climate change brings more extreme storms, investments in strengthening homes can pay off for homeowners and the insurance industry. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. For more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Zamon Perez, Mandy Stapleford, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.